All right, friends, we're out here in Northern Nevada on our first all-terrain family adventure of the year. Well, that's not true. I'm at the dining room table, editing this podcast while Danielle puts the kids to bed. But we did go exploring Northern Nevada today in crazy warm weather for the 2nd of January. Check out our photos on Instagram at allterrainfamily and video on the All Terrain Family channel on YouTube. Next, please enjoy my conversation with off-road journalist and photographer Harry Wagner as he tells about his adventures at the Rebel Rally, SEMA, the Baja 1000, and more. All right, here's episode 11 with Harry Wagner. All right, so I've got Harry Wagner back in the studio. You've had a super busy month with lots of events and cool things you've seen and done. You're here to tell us about it. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. I haven't been busy since I was here last.
Yeah. Where should we start? First thing you mentioned when you walk in the door was the Jeep thing.
Yeah, the JL.
Are you pretty excited about that?
Yeah, they've definitely done a good job, I think, of building anticipation for it.
Yeah.
And keeping the things that people like about a Wrangler. It still has solid axles.
Yeah.
The top still comes off.
It comes with a manual transmission.
You can get it with a manual transmission. Yeah, I think that's great.
That's pretty uncommon these days.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's going to be popular. I mean, they kept the parts people like. They made it lighter and more fuel efficient.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it'll be long before we see them with aftermarket axles and 37s.
Right.
And
well, I know they release all that stuff to the aftermarket people right away. I mean, before it comes out. So
right.
It should be good to go on that.
Yeah.
And I know the thing that I thought was pretty cool was the Rubicon comes with 33s.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I'm not super into the four-wheeling aspect of it. 33s are that's a big tire for me.
And yeah, it's to like, come from the factory like and to have to meet CAFE standards for fuel economy it's pretty impressive.
That's a big deal.
Tire. Yeah.
But then they can also do it there. There's a Mopar lift kit that'll put it up to 35s.
Right. 35s are the 2-inch lift. They had that green one at the show, the LA Auto Show, and it looked great. Yeah. The wheel wells, I mean, the big wheel wells, I think, are the key to why, well, there's a lot of things people like about Wranglers, but
right.
In particular, JKs and now JLs even more, you can fit a big tire. I mean, you look at a Cherokee, which is a great wheeling rig, but in order to fit a 33, you're looking at like a 4.5-inch lift or a lot of trimming.
Or some cutting, yeah.
Yeah, so it's impressive that 35s with a 2-inch lift.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, I mean, I like the, I had a CJ7, but, you know, that's an old basic vehicle, you know, and I like a little bit of the comfort thing, but mostly the safety, you know, if you're going to drive that thing around all the time with children in it or just by yourself, man, you want something that'll protect you.
Yeah.
Let's talk about SEMA. So you went to the SEMA show and the LA Auto Show, right?
I did not go to the LA Auto Show. That's going on right
okay,
now,
that's
actually.
Right now.
But
okay.
I did go to SEMA, which kind of segues nice with the Jeeps we're talking about,
right?
Because the JL wasn't launched yet at SEMA, so the aftermarket, all the companies I talked to said, yeah, we're just waiting to get our hands on one. Like you said, they have maybe some drawings, they've got plans, but until they actually test fit parts, they're not offering, well, and the vehicle's not out, so they don't need to offer
nobody
parts
wants
for it.
One yet.
But I thought it was interesting that the JK has been around for 10 years and is still the darling of the aftermarket. I mean, you go to the off-road hall, it's all JKs. And 10 years ago when it came out, it was about 50% JKs and 50% FJ Cruisers. They were released the same year. And it's interesting to see how one is, I mean, there's products available for the FJ Cruiser, but certainly not on the scale of JKs.
Now.
Yeah, they didn't have the staying power.
Well, you know, I mean, it was a forerunner on the bottom and something weird on top.
Right. Yeah.
And you either liked it or you didn't, but it wasn't really much different as far as I understand. So let's back up a little bit. So some of the listeners might not know what SEMA is.
Oh,
so SEMA is SEMA, and it stands for?
Specialty Equipment.
It's SEMA.
Correct.
Not CEMA. SEMA.
Specialty Equipment Manufacturers Association.
Okay.
So it's all aftermarket automotive parts. Everything from wiper blades and stereos to winches and tires and wheels.
Right. It's not just off-road.
It is not.
It's not just hot rods. I mean, if you look at like the Motor Trend channel or you know, those guys, they're talking about SEMA for hot rods, and there's
sure.
SEMA for like weird custom vehicles, and SEMA for mall crawler trucks.
There are a lot of show trucks at
show
SEMA.
Trucks,
it's
yeah.
You don't. There was a time when they were in magazines or other parts of society, but now it seems like they're just at SEMA. Like, I don't
oh,
see
really?
People with candy red powder coated axle housings anywhere
right.
but SEMA.
Right.
So I don't know where these trucks go when the show's over.
There's that one truck in town. You did a feature on it. It's the blue Silverado with a solid axle swap.
Okay. Yeah.
I saw that just this morning.
Yeah.
That thing's badass, but from a distance, it looks like a show truck, but it's not.
Right.
It's a legit truck.
Yeah. I think he actually off-roads that truck, and certainly it has the potential to do it.
Right.
You saw it going down the road.
And he daily
a lot
drives
of these.
It.
Yeah.
He used to either live next door or down the street from my dad, or would visit there all the time, because I saw it parked down the street from my dad's house. Anyway. What are the cool things that you see at SEMA? I mean, I know in the past it's been, you know, all kinds of custom, outfitted trucks. Like Kenda will have a truck outfitted. So you
right.
see a lot of eye candy all over the place.
Yeah, you definitely have to wade through the stuff that is just there to catch your eye for the actual functional products. But like AEV is a company
yeah.
I'm very fond of. They had a four-door Wrangler that was converted into a camper in their booth.
Yep.
That was super cool. That stands out. They also built a Chevy Colorado concept.
That was really
Chevy's
cool.
Chevy's booth. Yeah. So, which is, AEV has traditionally always been a Chrysler. They make Jeep stuff. They ventured into Ram.
Ram trucks, yeah.
But never any other manufacturer. So that was really interesting. I think.
Yeah, you've got an Instagram of that stuff.
I did.
They're very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, it was neat. I like the stuff that they make. I thought that there were a lot of Colorados actually at the show. So
mm-hmm.
not as many as Wranglers, but I would say as many Colorados as Tacomas, which I found interesting.
Yeah,
so.
The Colorados is starting to be pretty highly regarded. It seems like for my needs, it seems like a pretty good platform. If you get the, what's the off-road version?
The ZR2.
ZR2.
That comes with the Multimatic shocks, which are great.
Right.
You can get it with a diesel engine.
Yeah.
Like locking differentials
locking
front
differentials,
and rear.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great truck.
That would be a really good overlanding rig, you know, and I don't mind working and modifying an old 4Runner.
Sure.
You know? But like, you're talking about buying a brand new vehicle and then modding that, it seems like a much trickier proposition given all the custom stuff that's on vehicles these days, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think you would have to do much to a ZR2
no.
in order to make it really capable, and they already are really capable,
right?
So but yeah, you could certainly add your rooftop tent to it or
yep.
your accessories.
Yeah, for sure. So what kind of other products? There's a lot of overlanding stuff there, tents and freezers and.
Yeah, I felt there weren't a lot of, in the past there's been rock crawling vehicles in booths or Ultra 4 stuff, like King of the Hammers has been popular. Not a lot of either of those this year. There were
really?
Overlanding vehicles, though. A lot of things with rooftop tents.
Mm-hmm.
On vehicles, rooftop tents seem to be in vogue. So on vehicles that aren't necessarily overlanders.
Right.
But there are more options, I think, in rooftop tents. And then also fridges, too. So I have an ARB freezer fridge, which I'm fond of.
Right.
There's also Waco now, Black Forest, Dometic. So there were a number of options that some of which have been on the market or maybe overseas in Australia, they've been on the market,
right.
But to have a presence at SEMA was a first. So
I know, did you see the guys from Australia, they make the trailers. What is it? Patriot.
Okay.
Did you see those guys?
I did not see them at the show. I know they were at Overland Expo, though, and
they
I
were.
Hear good things about
them. I know maybe they were just at the show. Maybe he was just a spectator at SEMA, not with his product.
Well,
because he was posted a bunch of pictures. I thought maybe he was there.
And it's quite possible he was. I mean, the show is so big
right.
that I'll be there all week, and I find out about products later on Instagram or online or in magazines, and I was at the show, and there are things that I didn't see.
Right, right. That's funny. You mentioned giant, ridiculous UTVs?
Yeah, so the Diesel brothers built this UTV last year that was pretty over the top, and it seems to have caught on. So UTVs that have like Rice and Cane tires, I guess they're set up for mud pits or something. They have portal boxes, but I mean, these things are like 6 feet off the ground, bright colors in a UTV. So that was weird. It's also not really a UTV show. So I thought it was interesting this year.
Oh, yeah.
They had such a presence at SEMA. Yeah. So,
and because UTVs are basically like a quad. What does the U stand for?
So I think they're utility terrain vehicles.
That seems weird.
Yes, agreed. Maybe not, as I'm saying it.
But it's like, so it's
or
like
side by side.
Side by, that's what I've heard them called, a side by side, but it's like a quad. It's like a quad cycle with, you know, room for two or four people, and you drive it kind of like a car.
They're super popular, yeah. They're Polaris Razor.
They look like fun.
Every year, they're getting more powerful. They're getting better suspension, and you can go down and finance one and go out and have a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they're expensive.
You have to finance one.
I look at it like $10,000 plus for those things, and you know, you can get a used 4Runner or a used Bronco for less than five.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to breathe dust when you're going down the road.
Right.
SEMA. So what was your favorite thing at SEMA? What was the thing that you were like, I got to have that?
Probably that Colorado that AEV built is what comes to mind for me.
Yeah.
So in the past, I'm like you, I'm sort of Toyota biased. And in the past, Toyota's had some really cool vehicles in their booth. Last year, they had a lot of heritage vehicles from the 70s that had been restored. And they're not super fast, but they're definitely cool.
Right.
I like them. And this year, their booth was, there were no pickup trucks in it, nothing four-wheel drive, and it was pretty mundane. So I was disappointed. Typically Toyota in the past, there's been something in their booth I want to take home, but not this year.
Weird. What? Oh, so the Colorado. Yeah, that Colorado's pretty rad. I definitely want one of those.
Yeah.
So before that, it was like the week before that, you were at Rebel Rally.
Correct.
That was, and we had, if you remember, episode 7 or 6 or 8, or one of those episodes, we had two competitors from Sugar High Motorsports there, Michelle and Andrea. Did you see them down there? How'd they do?
Of course, yeah. So there's about 35 teams, which is big enough for a legit competition, but not so big. You get to know everyone over the course of, you know, it's a 10-day event. And yeah, Michelle brought macarons to the start also, so... she was friends with everyone because she brought sweets. So those were great. They had a lot of fun. They didn't have a great year. They didn't crash like they did last year, but definitely had some adversity and some mechanical issues to fight along the way. So they weren't alone in that regard.
So how did the event go? I mean, compared to, we guess we got a pretty good rundown of how it works, but how did it all unfold? Them, I mean, where was the main action? They were down in the desert a bunch.
Yeah, so it starts in Tahoe and then works its way through Nevada, through the desert, Dumont Dunes, which is near Death Valley, and then down through Johnson Valley, and it ends in Glamis. All great terrain. The event is sort of won and lost in the sand dunes, I think. That Emily Miller, the creator of the event, she really wanted to sort of introduce people to the premise early on and then ramp up the difficulty. And I think she did a good job with that. I've worked with Emily for, I don't know, maybe the last 10 years now. I've known her for a long time. And she does sports marketing in the past, but she also has raced off-road. She trains off-road. And I think she brings all those together to put together this event. And it's really good. I was really impressed. The food was great. The logistics were all really well handled. From the start, there's 36 teams, so there were 72 competitors, and there's nearly as many staff as there are competitors.
Wow.
So there are over 60 staff members between the food, course officials, safety officials, people doing logistics and setting up the base camps, people doing the timing and the scoring, media. There's almost 10 people on staff for doing media there. I mean, it's quite the production.
That's cool. So what was the difficulty? Was it navigation or driving? Was it an actual technical thing?
There is some difficulty in driving, certainly in the sand dunes in particular, as far as if you know where a point is, you still have to be able to get there.
Right.
But the event is won and lost with the navigator, in my opinion. I think that's really the most difficult aspect. And the team that won, Team Blanterage, Kaylee Hotchkiss, who won last year as well, was really consistent, a model of consistency, and that made the difference. So it was a close competition in the end. Nina Barlow came in second with Chris Main, and they were only 2 points behind, so super close, which makes it exciting and interesting,
yeah,
too.
Cool.
But weren't quite as consistent, which made the difference.
Ah, cool. What was so some of the vehicles I saw on that were, that Andrea and Michelle had a J something, TJ?
No, they have a TJ.
TJ.
Yeah. And it's modified. The women that won have a TJ that's modified as well.
Uh-huh.
There is an award for the best finishing stock vehicle. So that was Nina Barlow and Chris Main. They were in a Ram Power Wagon.
Oh, I saw that one, yeah.
And then the third place was Emmy Hall and Rebecca Donahue, who were in a ZR2, actually, that we've been talking about.
Oh,
so,
cool.
So a lot of OEMs have been involved. There was a Ford Raptor there. There's a Nissan Frontier, their Pro 4x edition that has a rear locker and stuff. So there were a fair amount of stock vehicles, and you can, if you have a capable stock vehicle, it's definitely not
right.
a hindrance. I mean,
well, that,
you, can do well,
you know, the stock vehicles you mentioned, the Power Wagon is, you know, that's a big truck. I don't know if it's lifted from the factory, but it's higher than normal, and it's got, you know, solid axles and lockers and disconnecting sway bars. I mean, it's basically like everything a Rubicon has.
Right. It's a big
scaled
Jeep,
up,
yeah,
to
with a V8.
Yeah. My buddy just got one of those as well. He really likes it. It's big, though. I mean,
they're big. Yeah.
Like coming from a Toyota 4Runner, things get big in a hurry. You know, our other vehicle's F-150, and it feels really big when I get in and drive it.
Yeah.
It's not my favorite, but. So the other, you were at another big race as well.
Yeah.
You were at Baja.
I just got back from the 50th Baja 1000.
Yeah. How was that?
It was okay. There were good aspects. So the plan was I was going to race. I was navigating for my friend Sam Cawthron, who has a shop here in town. We are racing in a car that belongs to Coast Aluminum. And the principal for that car, JJ Schnarr, we've raced with him in the past. He was nice enough to ask us back. The race course this year was actually 1,140 miles. So we had four drivers. The premise for the format for the Baja 1000, once it starts, you do the course nonstop.
Right.
So unlike a rally where you stop at night or you have time sections and liaisons. So, but you can change drivers, which you can't typically do in rally or rally rate events.
Now, does everybody get to change drivers, or is there like a solo class where one guy just does the whole thing?
There's not a class. There are people that do that.
And they just compete against everybody else.
Right.
Same Okay.
So I definitely think it's a disadvantage. You're basically going for bragging rights. But saying that, BJ Baldwin soloed the race. He had a navigator, which there's people question whether that's soloing or whether it's Ironmaning, but at any rate, BJ drove the entire race and won back-to-back a few years ago, so it certainly can be done, but I think you're at a distinct disadvantage to people who only have to be focused for 8 hours instead of 24 hours.
8 hours is a long time.
It's a long time to be focused, already. Right. And just even the logistics, like pre-running. So we went down, our section was from Loretto to La Paz, so race mile 834 to the finish at 1140. And we ran this section, and you're learning, okay, I need to go slow here. I need to go to the left here because on the right there's a big rock that might.
And are you writing that down?
So we have a GPS, and I'm making notes in the GPS as we're going. So if it's just a caution, like a ravine or something, I'll put skull and crossbones there. If I want to go left, I kind of make the arrow off to the left of the course, and then I'll put an arrow there. So they're pretty rudimentary notes.
And what are you using for a GPS for that?
Yeah, great question. So we, in the race car, we have a Lowrance, HDS7, or I don't exactly know what the model is, but we've typically used a Lowrance. I actually purchased LeadNav software and brought a tablet this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm racing with a friend in King of the Hammers and anticipating using lead nav. So I wanted to get familiar with it because I feel like you never want to learn something new in a race environment. So I've been putting off getting it just because it never seems like the right time.
Right.
So we didn't race with lead nav, but we downloaded the software, downloaded the course, and I definitely see advantages to it with satellite imagery.
Uh-huh.
And it's a lot, you have a touch screen, it's a lot easier to enter those notes and I think make them a little more distinct than just when we're racing. It's like there's a caution up ahead, but I can't tell him that it's a ravine or it's a rock, or
because you can't see the image, you can't see the image on Lowrance.
Well, typically we just make an icon when we're pre-running. We had 300 miles to cover, so we're not stopping long enough to make a note. It's just, did you get that? Yeah, I got it. Okay. We're going to keep going.
Huh. And there's some serious stuff down there. I've seen, rollovers where a truck will come around a corner and, if you're going at a normal speed, you'd be like, oh, I need to stop. But if you're going at breakneck speed at Baja, like a giant trophy truck will just roll over.
There's a lot of opportunities to have your day ended for sure.
Yeah. No joke. So you had some technical difficulties there.
Right. So as I mentioned, we were supposed to get in the car at Loretto at race mile 834, supposed to being the operative word.
Right.
So unfortunately the car didn't make it to us. It broke down at race mile 617 and was unable to continue, which is regrettable. I mean, being the 50th, I raced with JJ and the Coast Aluminum team back in 2013. And Sam and I did the last section of that race. And coming across the finish line is pretty surreal.
That's got to be awesome.
An amazing feeling, yeah. So we definitely were looking forward to that again. It didn't happen, but we ate some amazing tacos. Mm-hmm. You mentioned my Instagram page. You saw some of the beach photos or sunrise photos. I mean, the weather was perfect. We got to camp. We got to hang out with the friends. Pre-running was great. Sam recently put his... he actually has a race truck that we used to pre-run in that he just repowered with a LS3 spec engine, and it was pretty amazing. I was really impressed by
it. That's a race car, a race truck?
Yeah, so it's 6100 class Invest in the Desert, or trophy truck spec is what they call it in Score, and it's essentially unlimited suspension, but you have to run this sealed engine that's tagged. You can't mess with the engine.
Oh, okay.
So that's supposed to kind of level the playing field, make it a little more affordable.
Right.
Relatively.
Speaking. So it'd be like, what, like a $100,000 truck instead of a $1 million truck? Or?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, I think there's people now spending over $100,000 on these 6100 trucks. But yeah, it's not a trophy truck that, like you're saying, is $300,000 or $400,000.
I watched, I can't remember who it was. There was a video, a YouTube series where they were building a trophy truck, like from a tube frame. And they were trying to make a Raptor into a trophy truck. So they had like a cab and a front clip of a Raptor, and they were building, they were like scabbing it onto a trophy truck. And it was like a 5 or 6 part series. It was really cool to see the build, I mean, it's nothing like a vehicle, like a regular vehicle that you would drive. It's more like a giant UTV,
Well, and Sam's truck is a pure race truck. I mean, it's tube chassis. He left the body off of it for pre-running. So we're in basically an open cab. We've got on helmets. We've got on 5-point restraints.
There's ventilators and stuff.
Yeah. So we have on Parker pumpers. We have an intercom to communicate with each other. And it's like it's definitely not like driving in a car or truck.
Totally different. So pre-running, you go down and you're running probably faster than a normal person would drive, but not at race pace. And you're getting an idea of the course and making the notes. And so that's what pre-running is.
Yeah, basically.
There used to be like a, was it a Toyota that had the pre-runner, like the 80s and 90s? There was some truck that had pre-runner on it.
So you could get a Tacoma that was they called it a pre-runner, and it was basically built on a four-wheel drive chassis and had the e-locker in the back, but it was a two-wheel drive truck.
Okay.
And so that's in the States, there's not a lot of pre-running for desert races for liability concerns or impact concerns. In Mexico, that's the pre-running to me is as fun as the race. Like right. It's more relaxed pace. You get to stop at night. One of the course went past a mission, San Javier.
Right.
And so like we stopped there and we took a tour and looked around. So it's a great opportunity to explore new areas. But actually it's funny. The first time I went to Mexico was with Sam, but also with the Halls, like Rod Hall's family, to race. And they were pre-running. I had a third generation 4Runner at the mm-hmm. time. It was pretty well set up. It had air bumps and had 2.5-inch shocks on it. But I had driven it down and I was following them pre-running. And I didn't have a concept of what sort of speeds people pre-run at. So right. my thought was, I'm going down a bumpy dirt road. I'm not going too fast. I have to drive this thing home.
And right.
their idea was quite different. So I think in retrospect, they were probably pretty frustrated with the pace I was running. Sam, we were pre-running not at race speeds, but I would say at least 75% of race speeds. There were times where we were doing 100 miles an hour in this truck. And I'm like, we don't know what's over the rise. Yeah. The whole point is we're trying to find out what's over the rise. Right. But it also is valuable because the closer you are to race speeds, if you're going super slow, there might be a rock, but you have so much time to see it. You're like, oh, that's right. not a big deal.
You can't
deal.
Tell what a hazard is.
Right, exactly.
So tell me about Sam. He's local?
Yeah, Sam Cawthorn. He runs a shop called Samco Fabrication.
Okay.
And he kind of got his start with the Halls years and years ago. And now he has his own truck that he races. He builds race trucks. He does all sorts of vehicle builds. And
did he do your tracker?
He did some of my tracker. Yeah. So Jesse Haynes did the tube work and the suspension on the tracker. And then I took it to Samco Fab. It was kind of the best of both worlds. Jesse, super talented. He's also one guy. So I think I made the best use of his skills. And then it went to Sam's and they did all the wiring. They did the plumbing. They did the brakes and the fuel system. And, they do this on race cars for a living.
Right.
So they basically prepped it and got it ready. And it's been super reliable as a result.
Is that the place that's down there by Winco? There's at least some race car place down by Winco, South Winco? Sounds like no.
No, this is over by Summit Racing in Sparks.
Okay.
So the cool. industrial part of town.
Yeah. So he builds those kinds of vehicles so people will come to him and say, I need a race truck for such and such race. And,
yeah,
and he'll set them up with that.
Right. Yeah, he builds. Basically, desert racing is their bread and butter, mm-hmm. but then they also do, they build rock crawlers. They do other stuff too, and there's not enough business in Reno. I think if you were in Las Vegas or Southern California,
right.
you could be exclusive to building desert racing vehicles,
right.
but Reno, not quite that big yet, or
right.
doesn't have that affluent of a population.
Well, it's funny that there's so many, 4x4 off-road fab guys in Reno.
Yeah, there are. I mean, a disproportionate amount given the population.
Yeah.
But it's, we're close to the Rubicon. We're close to, if you want to go rock crawling, if you want to go desert racing, if you want to go overlanding, I mean, all of those opportunities are right out of our doorstep.
Well, also, if you're going to get a custom vehicle from somebody that's not in your town, you can fly into Reno pretty easily and get to just about anywhere pretty easily and drive it home. So,
yeah,
it's no big deal. So speaking of trucks, you got a new vehicle.
I did.
Last time you were talking about your
Tacoma. Right.
Yeah. So now you have a Tundra.
I did. And some of this has been, I mentioned my 4Runner. I regret selling that vehicle. It was pretty well set up. I really liked it. I got rid of it. And then I kind of tried to turn this Tacoma into the same thing that 4Runner was and that I liked about it.
Uh-huh.
The issue was just, it's a regular cab truck. The biggest things were it was a regular cab and it doesn't have cruise control. So the cruise control on long trips would just kill me.
It's pretty critical.
And the regular cab, it had a shell, an ARE shell on it that was lockable. So that was okay. But just accessing things in the back was an issue. So I sold that. And I also had another truck I kind of used for around town, like a shop truck.
Mm-hmm.
And that truck, the engine went out on. So I got rid of both of those trucks, combined them into one 2002 Tundra that I can use as a shop truck,
right.
but also have already put a lot of the parts on it that I liked from the Tacoma or the 4Runner, so similar components.
That's the first-gen Tundra is a vehicle that I've always looked at. It seemed like a pretty good vehicle, but you don't see too many of them set up, you know, properly for off-roading. Is it a pretty good vehicle for that? I mean, it's the same as the Tacoma pretty much, right?
Yeah, it's basically a scaled up Tacoma. Mm-hmm. I think so. It's not that much bigger than a second gen Tacoma.
Right.
But the prices are very reasonable. This one, you can get it with a V8.
Right.
So I really like the platform. I've really enjoyed it so far. It does everything I ask of it. So the issues that I had with the Tacoma, it's an access cab. So the back doors are like suicide doors, but enough room for my freezer, fridge, more lockable storage for like camera gear.
Right.
And then I actually towed a trailer with it when we were in Mexico. So big enough to do that, which I wouldn't do with the Tacoma.
Is that the 4.7 V8?
Yeah.
Or 7. So, that's pretty good.
I haven't had any issues with it. When I bought it, it had 150,000 miles on it, but the timing belt had already been changed, which is kind of a big service.
Yeah.
And otherwise, I had to do some maintenance. It needed brakes. It needed a window motor. But maintenance-wise, it didn't need a whole lot.
Hmm. And you found it locally, I guess?
No, it was in Phoenix, and I flew in and bought it and drove it home. So
there's a lot of 4Runners in Phoenix. A friend of mine, or Toyota products in general, a friend of mine got a 07 limited, really nice, limited V8 4Runner for, he said, $7,000.
Wow.
With less than 200,000 miles on it. So it's a pretty nice vehicle.
Yeah, and you don't have to worry about rust or anything like that.
Yeah, so Phoenix Craigslist.
That's it.
So what all have you done with that? You said you got two and a half inch shocks.
Right. So I had bought it not long before the Rebel Rally, and it was in essence stock when I went on that, which was kind of a good baseline. And then I did a bunch of upgrades. Samco, those guys put a bunch of parts on it before we took it to Mexico.
Right.
So I got a Relentless Fabrication skid plate for it. They're a local company.
Yeah, those guys are here.
Yeah. And I got 2.5-inch ADS shocks and Specialty Products upper control arms from Slee Off-Road.
Mm-hmm.
And been really pleased with those. I got Dever leaf springs for the back. I put some 33-inch BFG all-terrains on it. And then the only other thing was I got a backflip, like, folding tonneau cover.
Okay, yeah.
And I've been really pleased with that. I have a similar product on my Ram. And it, with the locking tailgate, you have lockable storage, but you can still open it up and put taller products in it, unlike a camper shell. The other biggie for me versus a camper shell is that you can fold it all the way forward, so things in the front of the bed you can still access. Camper shell wasn't like a contractor type where you could open the side windows up. So the things in the front, you're crawling over everything to try and get to.
Yeah.
No, that's not the case with this.
Pickup truck bed access is difficult. When we go overlanding or camping in our F-150, I put a Yakima racks on it with our boxes. I have two of those boxes, so I just put those on there so we can lock stuff up. But then everything that's underneath them, I can't get in the sides, and then I have to crawl in the front. So it's a challenge, and it's a full size bed on that thing.
Right.
So ADS shocks, I haven't heard of those.
Yeah, they're a company out of Tucson. I had Kings on my Tacoma, no complaints about those. I had Icons on my 4Runner. I really liked those. Mm-hmm. I have Fox on my Ram. So I'm not specific to one brand of shock. Right. I think they're all very good. The deciding factor for me on the ADS shocks, I actually have those on my Tracker. Mm-hmm. I have ADS shocks. And then my buddy Ben that I race with at King of the Hammers, he has ADS shocks on his race truck, and they really served us well. But the biggest thing was just the delivery time. So I think it's a comparable product, and it's comparable in price also. But when I got the Foxes for my Ram, it took 4 or 5 months to get them. And
wow.
You know, Fox is making products now for the Raptor from the factory and for a lot of these side-by-sides we were talking about. So I think they're kind of scrambling to keep up.
Mm-hmm.
Where the ADS shocks, I ordered them, and less than a week later they showed up. And
now, do you have to customize them for the vehicle, or do they customize them for the vehicle, or is it just a general thing?
It was a bolt-on shock, so it's designed to fit the Tundra, and you could valve them differently. I just they valve them for a Tundra. It gives about 2.5 inches of lift in the front. So it's a 2.5 inch diameter body, and then the coilover and remote reservoirs. And then in the back, another reason I went with ADS was they have a true 2.5 inch diameter rear shock with a piggyback reservoir.
Okay.
And you can get Icon makes a 2.5 inch rear shock for a Tundra, but most, it seems like King and Fox, they just do a 2 inch in the back. But I think you need the control as much in the rear as you do in the front. So you could revalve them. I haven't, maybe there's room for improvement, but I've been really happy with how they're
good enough so far.
Yeah.
And Relentless, I've stopped by and talked with them. They make bumpers and I think it's mostly bumper front and rear bumpers and skid plates and stuff, mostly for Toyotas, mostly for Tacomas and 4Runners. But they seem to be pretty busy. Have you you know those guys well?
I know them fairly well. Yeah, I like you said, they make armor for Toyotas, and they're somewhat busy locally, but they also have a big web presence, so they ship a lot of products. They're on a lot of forums, and I think every time I go by it, they seem super busy.
Yeah.
They've got a bigger shop now and more equipment in there every time I go by, so they're making moves. Yeah, Eric that owns the place, he's a young guy, and
he's
done really well.
That's cool. It's awesome. You know, and he does everything, you know, with computer design. And I know that he's got like some computer controlled equipment, like water jet cutters. And so they do legit stuff over there. It looks real nice. It seems like one of their signature things on the bumpers is the big flare, you know, bar that's like flares out and matches the hood line really well. Looks pretty cool. What else we got to talk about?
Oh shoot!
What do you plan to do in the Tundra? I mean, that's an overlanding vehicle, basically.
Yeah. So the goal was something that I can take on trips like to Baja or to the Rebel Rally. It's got a decent range, like 350 mile range per tank of fuel. It's comfortable and roomy. It's not so nice of a truck that I'm like scared to leave it in Mexico and walk away from it, or I don't want to load a transmission in the bed because I'm afraid I'll scratch it.
Right.
So it fits a lot of needs that I have, and yeah, I've really fallen in love with it.
It's not big. I mean, it was marketed as a full-size truck, but it's not that big.
No, like I said, I don't consider it really much bigger than a modern Tacoma.
Does it have a full-size bed? Like,
it has a 6-foot bed.
6-foot.
So it's like a short bed truck.
Yeah.
So big enough for most of my needs.
That was 2002, was before short bed became 5.5 foot.
Right.
Right. So now it's 5.5 foot, 6.5 foot, 8 foot, or 7 foot, or whatever it is. And short bed used to be 6 feet. Is that right?
That's my understanding.
The super short bed is new.
Yeah, I think that's like a crew cab thing
where
they're trying to keep the vehicles from getting too long. And that's, you know, I consider getting a crew cab or I guess double cab is what they call it in a Tundra. But I didn't really need the room, and I'm pretty happy with the purchase decision because, yeah, the size of the truck, I think I can definitely take it overlanding or fit it a lot of places on trails around here. It's pretty nimble. I like the size. I don't imagine there's going to be a lot of places that I would have taken my Tacoma that I won't take this truck.
Right. Yeah, it seems like a good vehicle. One of our friends has used to have a Sequoia, first gen Sequoia, which
I think is that shares a lot of the same.
I think it's basically the same truck.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's coils in the rear or leaves, but it looks like the same truck from the doors forward at least. And it always seemed like a nice vehicle, sort of a step between the 4Runner and the
Land Cruiser.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you've done, do you have articles out on all this stuff yet, or are they forthcoming in some of the magazines? Or
yeah, I covered the Rebel Rally for Outdoor by Four.
Okay.
And also for Off-Road Adventures, which the magazine Four Wheel Parts puts
out.
Yep,
I just got that.
Yeah. SEMA, I did some stuff for the Four Wheeler Network that's already online.
Right.
And then Baja, I was just for fun. So I'm not writing any stories about it. I didn't want to commit myself to racing and also to trying to write a story.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we'll post links to that and hopefully have some of that here. What have you got coming up in the future?
I have some geophysics work to do that takes me out of town. So I'm headed to San Diego next week and then to Gallup, New Mexico, which is a pretty beautiful area.
Gallup is awesome.
Yeah. So I'm going to take the Tundra and hopefully do some exploring when I'm down there.
Yeah.
A lot of my trips sort of, I'll let the company pay for it and then take the opportunity when I'm someplace to explore a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
After that, we're getting into the holidays, so I plan to be home. And then King of the Hammers is the first week of February, so that'd be the next big one for me.
King of the Hammers. I like watching the videos of that.
Yeah.
That's some impressive stuff when they're taking those. It's an Ultra 4, right?
Right. That's the series, yeah.
And so what is the definition of Ultra 4?
So Ultra 4 vehicles have to be four-wheel drive, mm-hmm. which is kind of what distinguishes them from most desert racing vehicles are not four-wheel drive. They're two-wheel drive. But a lot of the same... There's a lot of desert racing influence, but it's a vehicle that also can scale rocks.
And, yeah, because they're doing real rock crawling.
Pretty legit rock crawling.
Ridiculous, impossible stuff. So those trucks are... It seems like half of them are... solid axle front and rear, and maybe is it like half and half full independent? Because there's a lot of full independent ones too. Or maybe that's just what you see on the videos.
There's originally they were all solid axle. There's definitely, I don't know if it's quite half and half, but there's more independent front suspension every year. Mm-hmm. I think most of them are still running solid rear axles.
Yeah.
The exception would be Cody Wagner from Lasernut had Armada Engineering build him a fully independent vehicle that has portal axles at the ends.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty wild. Yeah, it's still sort of in the concept phase, I guess. I mean, he's racing it, but it's so far out of the box that there's been some teething issues, I would say. But it certainly shows a lot of potential. And the IFS now, I would say, is as strong. It's become pretty robust. That wasn't initially the case, but it's definitely faster in the desert and over small rocks is, I think, the biggest difference because it really absorbs those and you can go faster. But the downside is the cost of the vehicle. The components are pretty expensive for those front ends, and then there's a lot more prep involved between races too, so that adds expense too. So
yeah,
like the car that I'm racing in with my friend Ben is Jimmy's 4x4 is probably the most prolific chassis builder. He has a Jimmy's 4x4 car, and it's solid axles front and rear, and it's pretty simple, but it's served us well and been reliable. Last year we just took fuel the whole race, so we did have a sway bar break. We had to stop and take that off, but otherwise, we had a good race.
So that's a vehicle that he built from parts, or is it the Jimmy's 4x4? Do they sell complete vehicles?
Yeah, so originally Ben had a chassis from Jimmy's and had completed it himself in his previous vehicle, and then this time around he just got a turnkey vehicle. They built so many that they really, there's no need to reinvent the wheel. They really kind of know how to package things, know what fits and what doesn't, and the best place to route the exhaust or the cooling system and things like that.
That sounds cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're coming up on 45 minutes here, so we'll cut it off here. But hopefully we'll come back and we can do this again sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. I always enjoy coming in, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you. So
awesome.
I'm already campaigning for the next time I can come back.
Yeah. Well, we'll do something. Thanks for coming.
Follow Harry Wagner on Instagram at Harry Situations. And subscribe to this podcast wherever you get podcasts. And also share it with your friends. You know, why not? The All Terrain Podcast is created by me, Mike Henderson, at the Reno Collective in Reno, Nevada, and sometimes at my dining room table. Thanks for listening.